Good morning to everybody again. It's good to see my brothers and sisters in the Lord who are with us today, who are part of the congregation here. And we welcome also those of you who are our guests. We say welcome to those of you who are live streaming with us this morning as well. And we appreciate hearing from you and knowing that you're with us and that you're praying for us. This is a time of the year when people have the delightful tradition of remembering when the incarnation, as we call it, when the Son of God is born in human form, and we delight in the cultural tradition where we, with that in mind, decide what we want to give each other, and we exchange gifts with each other. I wonder what kind of an impact it would have on us if instead we thought more about the ending of the incarnation and about what kind of gifts the Lord wanted the Father to give to Him for that reason and on that occasion. That would be actually a more edifying exercise. And I mean by that one that would build us up spiritually, and it would have more of a biblical footing in terms of a celebration even. I'm not speaking against enjoying the cultural traditions that go on in our lives. I think we need celebrations and we need things that we enjoy in our lives. But we're creatures who are very easily put into the practice of only thinking of what we enjoy and not being disciplined by what the Lord wants. I read somewhere the observation that it would be interesting to know just how much it would change people who embrace the concept of Christianity if we all would remember that we have been prayed for by the Lord, and if we contemplated what the Lord prayed for us, and then what kind of an impact that should have and how we live from day to day. So this morning, I want for us to try to think what we would be because He prayed for us. What it means to us that He has prayed for us. What it means to us with each other to know that He has prayed for us. That's a privilege that we have in looking in on John chapter 17. So this morning, this study is an easy thing to follow. His prayer and our aspiration. His prayer is our aspiration. We love Him. We want what He wants to become true in our lives. That's the idea. So let's start with His prayer. We follow the development of John 17. It starts with the fact that He lifted up His eyes to heaven in verse 1. Do that for a minute in your mind. If not physically, then mentally, in your mind, lift up your eyes to heaven. Really, this is a bigger turning point than it may look. You all know that the previous four chapters have all involved Jesus' farewell to his disciples on the night when He's going to be betrayed. At the end of chapter 16, halfway through that last verse, the Lord said, "In the world you will have tribulation, but take heart, I have overcome the world." And with that thought in mind, it says that when Jesus had spoken these words, He lifted up His eyes to heaven and He said, "Father, the hour has come. Glorify Your Son, that the Son may glorify You." For our purposes this morning, when we read the word glorify, please think that which causes someone to be known for who he really is. For who that person really is. Don't think of glory as shining off in the beyond of eternity. Think of it as that which shows someone to be who he really is and causes him to be known for who he really is. Father, the hour has come, the hour of betrayal, trial, mistreatment, suffering, death, resurrection. The hour has come. Let it be known who I am and who you are in this hour. Then the next step in our thought process is in verse 9. Look down at it. Jesus says here, I am praying for them. He's prayed for himself already. I'm praying for them, he says. I'm not praying for the world. I've come into the world. I've loved the world. I'm seeking the world. But right now, I'm not praying for the world. I'm praying for those whom you have given me, for they are yours. And he'll go ahead to say in verse 20, I don't ask for these only, but also for those who will believe on me through their word. That's why Justin could say earlier, we've all been prayed for. The Lord is praying for the people who have been receptive to what he has been making known. If you look at verse 6 and verse 8, I manifested your name to the people whom you gave me out of the world. And then he says in verse 8, I've given them the words that you gave me, and they've received them and have come to know the truth that I come from you, and they have believed that you have sent me. I am praying for them. Are you in that number this morning? Are you included in the scope of this prayer? The fact that you're here today shows that you at least have an interest in that or want to be. All of us do, I hope. I'm praying for them. At that moment, the Lord prayed for us. And then verse 11, his prayer has one overriding theme. I'm no longer in the world, but they are in the world, and I'm coming to you. Holy Father, keep them in your name, which you've given me, that they may be one, even as we are one. Your name, which you have given me, that they may be one, even as we're one. Now think about this for a moment. If you look at this prayer in a broader sense, it's been, the Lord's ministry has been about revealing God's name. If you look at verse 4, I glorified you on the earth. And then if you look at verse 26, I made known to them your name. Those of you who have been in our class with us on Wednesday evenings, you can go back and look this up and study with us if you'd like to. But remember in Exodus chapters 33 and 34, after the golden calf incident, Moses is up on the mountain when the first tables of the Ten Commandments have been broken. And he prays to the Lord, show me your glory. And then the Lord puts him in the cleft of the rock and passes by and proclaims his name. Show me your glory. The Lord proclaims his name. Jesus' ministry says, I've glorified you. I've made known your name. When the Lord passed by, what he said is, the Lord, the Lord. And then he made it clear what his own character and what his own identity really is, what his own nature really is. He is a God who is compassionate and gracious and patient and good and true and forgiving and righteous and just. Jesus came into a world where those qualities did not exist. They did not rule people's lives. They were not the way we people lived. And he made God known. He revealed who God is. He modeled who God is. This is the name you've given me. This is the person I have been and I have taught them to be. They have received this. They've been fashioned and molded by your name. Now keep them grounded in this. Make this reality for them. Make them people who are compassionate and gracious and patient and good and true and forgiving and righteous and just. Keep them that way and make them one that way, because they're in the world. Jesus mentions the world in this chapter 19 times. I'm coming to you. Now then, they're in the care of your name. Now, that's the prayer. What does it mean in terms of our aspiration? When I mention aspirations, I'm talking about what we want to be, what we want to come, what we'd like to become, what we'd like to live up to, what we hope happens in our lives, what our goals and our dreams are. What's our purpose? That's the idea. And here's what I see. And I wrote about this 2 weeks ago, one day, for our thought for the day, and what I asked us, what I said we could pray for that day. And I'd like to look a little more closely at this chapter in this sense. Our aspiration is that the Lord's joy may be fulfilled in us. This is verse 13. Please notice verse 13. I'm coming to you, and these things I speak in the world that they may have my joy fulfilled in themselves. I'm praying this so that they can have my joy fulfilled themselves. The Hebrew writer made the point that the Lord endured the cross, despising the shame, because he looked to the joy set before him. What was his joy? In this chapter, his joy is that he has accomplished the work that the Father gave him to do, verse 4. His joy is that he has loved people and provided for them the great blessing which he was in the process of fulfilling in that hour. My hour has come, verse 1. I've dedicated myself for their sake, verse 19. I've loved them, verses 25 and 26. And the Lord's joy is that he knows there is glory awaiting him still with the Father again. So his joy is that he's accomplished a work. He has given himself to bless people. And he's going to be at the Father's right hand. We want his joy to have its real impact in our lives. We want it to have meaning in our lives. We want to also be people who accomplish the work he gives us, who are a blessing to the world around us, and who have the hope of being at home with him in glory. That's why we're here, what we want. A chapter earlier, Jesus said something to his disciples about their joy that's important. Verse 20 of chapter 16. Truly, truly, I say to you, you will weep and lament. So this isn't just a happy feeling we're talking about here. But the world will rejoice. You'll be sorrowful, but your sorrow will turn to joy. When a woman is giving birth, she has sorrow because her hour has come, but when she's delivered the baby, she no longer remembers the anguish for joy that a human being has been born into the world. So also you have sorrow now, but I'll see you again, and your hearts will rejoice, and no one will take your joy from you. Think of that. There will be a victory then that no one takes from you. Your sorrow will arise. Your sorrow will turn to joy. No one takes your joy from. I ran across a story from the second century retold. In the second century, they bring a man before the king who is about to be martyred. The king wants him to recant his faith and to give up Christ. And the man just rejects that possibility out of hand. So the king says, if you don't do it, I'll banish you. And the man answers, you can't banish me from Christ. He says he'll never leave me or forsake me. So the king says in his anger, well, I'll confiscate your property and take it all from you. And the man answers him, my treasures are laid up on high. You can't get to them. The king begins to be even more angry, and he says, I'll kill you. The man answers, I've been dead 40 years. I've been dead with Christ, dead to the world. My life is hid with Christ in God, and you can't touch it. That's joy that can't be taken from you. And that's what the Lord prays, and that's our aspiration. Not that we want to be killed for our faith, but when we die, we want it to be with our faith. Second, our aspiration, the Lord's Prayer, and our aspiration is that we may be kept from the evil one. Verse 15. Jesus seems to regard evil as a personal force. He's already said in chapter 14, the prince of this world comes. He has nothing in me. That would be, he'd be talking about Satan in that way, the ruler of this world. In verse 15, he says, maybe I could read 14 first. I've given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, even just as I'm not of the world. So notice here, the world is the realm of people who do not receive the Lord's word and who hate the Lord and what he stands for. And hate his people as a result. It's not just people. It's a way of thinking and a way of being that he calls the world. I do not ask that you take them from out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one. Now think about that. The evil one seeks to destroy faith. The evil one seeks to destroy relationship. Wherever he is, whatever he does, he seeks to destroy relationship between people and God, between people and each other, and really more deeply down, between the person and his true self. He'll do it either with the lust of the flesh or the lust of the eyes or the pride of life. But he seeks to do harm, and he seeks to divide between people and their God. He seeks to mar the name of God in the lives of people. Jesus said, I don't pray that they be taken out of the world. I ran across something that I've probably collected a long time ago in working on this. It was written by Paul Sherrill. Pam, did you tell me one time Paul was your preacher before? So here, let me remind you what he said. Okay, I saw this in an old bulletin article. It's the prayer Jesus refused to pray. Jesus could have anything he wanted. 10,000 angels showed that this morning. He knew it. Anything he asked for is his. Rocks to bread, legions of angels. Yours for the asking. The prayers of Christ are bold. Dead people came to life. Storms stopped. Natural law was overcome. That's why we read with such interest his prayers, especially his prayer in John 17. We notice the things he asked for, and we notice something else. There's a prayer he refused to pray. It's in verse 15. I do not pray that thou shouldst take them out of the world, but that thou shouldst keep them from the evil one. Now, he's already said we belong to him and he loves us and the world hates us, but he refused to pray that we be taken out of the world. We're here, and that's where we're supposed to be. We're His body. We have work to do. We're light. We have darkness to dispel. We're salt. We're to influence the world. Jesus said that we're not of the world, but we are in it. That's how He wants it. That's something for us to think about. The Lord prays that we be kept from the evil one. Therefore, we seek to be well from the evil one's influence. Third, the Lord prayed that we be set apart as the Lord's, that we be set apart as holy, that we be made holy by the truth of His word. This is verse 17, notice. Really 17, 18, and 19. Sanctify them. Now the word sanctify that's used here is exactly the same word as in the middle of verse 11 when Jesus said, Holy Father. Holy is one form of the word. Sanctify is a verb form of the exact same word. So I could read, make them holy. Make them like You are, Father. You are compassionate and gracious and patient and good and true and forgiving and righteous and just. Make them holy by the truth of Your word. The word make holy can also mean, you'll notice this in some translations, set them apart for this purpose in the world. Make them Your instruments for bearing testimony to Your name in the world. Your word is truth. Now Jesus has said earlier in verse 8, I've given them the words that You've given to Me. If God is true, then His words are true, and that's what He uses to make us like He is. In other words, to make us His children, to fashion us. As You sent Me into the world, so have I sent them into the world. And for their sake, I sanctify, or make holy, or dedicate, or consecrate Myself, that they also may be made holy, or dedicated in truth. Truth is a word today that's not culturally in fashion. If it is, then it's spoken of as my truth. Well, that's your truth, and I've got my truth. The thing that makes us holy is His truth. And it's the instrument that Jesus is praying the Father will use to fashion people into His name and to use them for His service and to make them a testimony to His ways in this world. Then move down to verses 21. Really, I could start at 20, but I'm going to read through 23. Our aspiration is that we may be made one with each other and with the Lord, in such a way that the world can believe that God sent Him and loves them. Listen to this. I do not ask for these only, but also for those who will believe on Me through their word, that they may all be one, just as You, Father, are in Me and I in You, and that they also may be in us, so that the world may believe that You have sent Me. The glory that You've given Me, I've given to them, that they may be one, even as We are. I in them, You in Me, that they may become perfectly one, so that the world may know that You sent Me and love them, even as You love Me. Now, there's a whole lot packed in those three verses, but you can see the point. He is praying for a particular kind of unity to exist in these people God has given to Him. He wants them to be one, apostles and those who believe the words of the apostles, that they all may be one, to start with verse 20 and 21. The church now has to have a connection with the apostles and what they taught and wrote, or else we're not the church the Lord wants us to be. Second, he wants there to be a relation, a spiritual relation among those that are his, that's like the relation between him and his Father. Now, what kind of relation is it that exists between him and the Father? There is a oneness between them. It's not that they're the same person. Here's one fellow standing here in the world praying to a Father that he looks up to in heaven. They're not the same person. But they have been thinking the same thing. They have the same nature. Jesus is exactly the same name or identity or character that the Father has. They've been at work in the same great purpose that they're trying to accomplish, and they have the same desires for the people that the Father has given the Son. It's a spiritual unity in that way. Third, this is a unity which can be observed by the world. It cannot simply be claimed, we are united in ways you cannot see. This is a unity of spirit, not a division in spirit, but a unity in spirit where we say the same thing, speak the same thing, and are the same thing. Where it comes to our relation to the Lord. And we don't let other things put us so at odds with each other that we publicize it in every possible way. 1 Corinthians, the whole letter to 1 Corinthians would be in a case study in this, in a world where there are a bunch of different ideas. There are some things that are non-negotiables. Those things identify the nature and character of God, and they have to be worked out in the matters of opinion that are not faith questions that come along in everyday lives. Oh Lord, we want to be one in such a way that the world can believe you sent Christ and that you love them right now. And then we aspire to finally be with the Lord and see Him as He is. Verse 24. Father, I desire that they also whom you have given me may be with me where I am to see my glory. Now, as I've mentioned before, to see me for who I really am. To see me the way I was with you before I laid that aside and took on flesh. The glory that you've given me because you love me before the foundation of the world. Oh, righteous Father, even though the world does not know you, I know you, and these know that you sent me. I made known to them your name, and I'll continue to make it known that the love with which you've loved me may be in them and I in them. That's the kind of glory that we hope and expect will be fulfilled in the Lord's own good time. John celebrated this in 1 John 3 and verse 3 when he wrote about the time when we will see him as he is and be like him. Now, how do you take this prayer in John 17? It is, after all, the Lord standing there, lifting up his eyes to heaven and praying with these friends of his, these disciples of his, standing around watching. This isn't a series of commandments. This is a prayer. And yet you can't help but think that the Lord wants them to learn from this prayer and to be fashioned by it, and that wants them to understand that they're invited into trying to live up to what he's been praying. I remember a line I ran across in a little book Justin gave me, "You are what you love." There's a line in it written by someone who said, "Your deepest desire is the one manifested by your daily life and habits. This week, may our daily life and habits indicate that our deepest desire is that the Lord's Prayer is more important to us than anything else. That's enough to keep us busy this week. But this is a prayer. The Lord was turning it over to His Father's hands. Remember, the Father is involved in this project and ultimately is the one who decides its fulfillment. You're invited to participate in what the Lord prayed for here. If we can help you to make the good confession and to be baptized into His name, or if there is a way in which there's prayer needed over something in your life that hadn't been right, then this is a moment when we invite you to let that be known while we stand and sing together.